much. Thank you.
I think I'm good.
Thanks. Thank you so much, Deanna. I've wanted for a long time, because I sent you several messages on Facebook. I wanted very much to be a part of this project, and I'm so pleased to be here tonight, and I want to thank you again. And it's also particularly lovely to be here with A.F. Moritz. Or should I just call you Al? We were discussing this earlier. It was quite a controversy. We'll go with Al. I like Al. And I do like Al. He was my teacher when I was at the University of Toronto. I took his creative writing workshop, course, I should say, not workshop, it was a proper course, a long time ago, in the late 1990s. So he actually was the first person to read the first poem, really, that I wrote, and to provide me with feedback and support. And I should say that when I look back on my time at the University of Toronto, which I don't often do, but when I do, it's the one course that I remember not feeling like a student number. It was the one course that had a sense of fellowship and community, and I've always carried very fond memories of that course and of your support, so I won't say anything more than that, except I'll see you in Fredericton, right? Okay, great. Also, my dad is here tonight, which means that I can't read any of the more explicit or graphic sexual poems in my book. That's about half the book. So, and I haven't had anything to drink to sort of free me of that. And then, so, yes, my father's here, my husband is here, and my first male mentor. There's a lot of terrifying male energy here. So, so much judgment. But, I think I'm going to start with a poem that actually I hope my dad will enjoy. When I was a child, my father would often take me out for a lobster dinner. And the memories that I keep of that is that he really seemed to enjoy watching me tear into a crustacean. So I have written a poem about it called Lobster Dinner. How my father loved watching me at the table. A contest. Could I pick out every scrap from the carapace, a surgeon unaided? He demonstrated the basics. At 11, I could go it alone. I went to work with my tools, nutcrackers, two tin, I'm gonna mispronounce a ton of words because I've been teaching students all day and I'm just out of it, so you'll have to forgive me. I'm sorry. I went to work with my tools, nutcrackers, two-tined fork. Like at Passover Seder, each item before me mattered. The wet nap for my treif hands, lemon-scented. The bib emblazoned with a cheery cartoon of the brute I would soon devour, waving its crushing claw in greeting. Wear it in good health, Father said. Breathe deep, then wrench the claws off the trunk. One hand grasps thorax as the other hand wrestles. Off with the tail, now the legs. Suck up all 10 like wee coral bagpipes plump with gristle. Quarter both goons, pincer and crusher at their joints. Pluck the flaps, those spiny rose petals off the fin. Find the smallest entrance on the mangled tail. Ease finger in and push meat out intact. Turn your head and cough, Father said. That ball of red snot in the cavity couldn't put me off my repast. I ate the proof my arthropod too was a girl. I can't undo the wrong I've done. Still, I reverse the home movie. Watch as I blow life into legs with oiled lips, join tail flaps like stucco tiles. From my mouth, an empty fork issues, bearing tissue from my insides to bolster my golem. I attach tail, legs, and claws to trunk with gusto. The waiter backs off with the slab, then my fresh scrubs. Today, I'm a lacto-vegetarian who lacks the stomach for the seafood aisle. To think I would hover at such a tank, holding my father's hand as I selected my supper. Meanwhile, mother's fingers, daring, dive into barrels of salt-cured herring, high blood pressure be damned. Between them, three biopsies, radiation therapy, 2 rounds, 1 heart attack leading to short-lived clinical death, 1 artificial coma, 1 pacemaker, 1 benign brain tumor, 1 shunt, 1 case of sepsis, 1 splenectomy. And those are just entre mains. What hubris makes me think that, opting for tofu, I get to opt out? Consume what suffers. You're not done, hold on, you've still got your sea legs, that green gunk. While your heart's still in it, old broad, while you've still got the stomach and butter, dunk till that plate is as clean as your stone. Okay. The next poem is actually the title poem, The Panic Room. Also, The Panic Room, glue ear at 45, so I don't know if anyone has had the experience of having a tremendously blocked up ear and what an unpleasant experience that is. But I did at 45, okay. The nurse peers inside my right ear, fluid trapped there inside the canal, turning my skull into a bridge of sighs only I can hear. Some seaside bully has sealed shut my ear with wet sand. I try not to shout when I speak, chew gum all day like a bad actor. I pinch my nostrils shut with thumb and finger, exhale for the decreed 10 to 15 seconds. Comes the crackle of fat in a distant skillet, but no relief. Through the padded wall of a panic room, my voice reaches me. My good ear, unappreciated, unsung and besieged, like the one son who visits me faithfully. You'll turn your back on me too one day. Oh, Ma, he says, slicing into the birthday cake he's brought me. We all will. Okay, I think I'm gonna read something provocative. I can't resist. So the last section of this book is based on experience that I had when I lived in France for 3 years. Yeah. And during that time, I had a boyfriend for 2 weeks. And he was a truck driver. And he transported live fish across the European Union. And during our two-week relationship, I went with him. And so the last section of the book details that experience, in particular the experience that I had of being in this very male, sort of macho environment of truck drivers. So I'm gonna read this poem about the experience that I had. We took a ferry, we were traveling from France, the south of France, on our way to Greece, to one of the Greek islands, so we had to take a ferry. And I don't know if anyone here has ever been on a ferry from Italy to Greece with dozens of truck drivers. I don't know if that's something. Okay, so just me. So this is sort of the experience. It's called The Ferry. And the name I've given this particular truck driver is Didier. I chose the one French name I have the most difficulty pronouncing. Take what you need for the night, Didier says, cleaning his good shoes. I climb down from the cabin to find a procession of professional mourners. Black-robed widows tailgate a coffin, moans mingling with the truckers' multilingual calls to each other. Then cement becomes claret and gold carpeting. Didier's told me there's a disco on board and 2 restaurants, fine dining and casual. Truckers in denim and leather emerge from the garage, swarm the check-in, work boots, trampling fleur de lis. Room cards in hand, they converge on the lounge. My first time drinking on water. Truckers slouch on vinyl banquets beneath chandeliers. Didier orders Jack Daniels. For me, white wine, chilled. Smell of tobacco, sweat, lighter fluid. The bar stools upholstered in fake whale foreskins are tested. A couple, backpackers, Observe me from the far shore of this smoking sea of work-worn men aged 19 to 60. The man drinks his beer, his woman, Cour Royal. I recognize their addition of grease on a shoestring, the same white stone church against the same blue sea. Didier chooses this moment to show off his trick of crushing a beer can against his brow. The woman elbows the man who searches his backpack for a phone, calling Interpol, I'm sure, to report a victim of sex trafficking in her 20s, Southern or Eastern European or Roma based on her coloring, no obvious signs of abuse, well-fed but clearly exhausted. And this is the final poem from the section that also takes place on the ferry. It's called Last Night They Were Gods. So we're still with the truckers in the ferry. Last night they were gods, for they dined at communal tables, busboys rushing to refill water goblets and baskets of bread, their voices a babble of Indo-European languages. Gob shite, the blue-eyed Tunisian from Marseille echoed to the Brit's delight. Didier lifted a buttock and farted. Good lad, said the cork-sniffing Scotsman. When Piraeus approached, the men retraced their steps to slump inside their cabs. In the kitchen, the waiters rolled the linen tablecloths and drowned them in bleach. Okay. This one is about my maternal grandfather, who passed away in 2008 at the age of 91. It's called Sunnybrook Hospital, Toronto. It's dedicated to him, Murray Libin, 1917 to 2008. Comfortable, sir? The nurse asked, adjusting grandfather's pillow under his head. Never one to resist a kibitz. I make a good living, he said. Mother combed out his knotted hair while he read the sports page. From the age of 20, he'd Christianized those dark curls with Brill cream, just like his chavarim, his good fellas. He crooned the jingle to me in my cradle. A little dabble, do ya? That follicles are now tested for DNA and banned substances wouldn't surprise him. A man's pate will always rat him out. And so, in old age, he gave up the pomade and went au naturel, his graying Jufro, the reclaimed, free-born crown of every self-made man and his bookie, who answered to Baruch and Sheldon, who drove Lincoln Continentals, who played gin, rummy, and mahjong, who wore velour sweatsuits and sandals, who dropped out of Harvard Collegiate, who toasted at Seder's next year in Manhattan, who, deploring the weight of their unshorn heads at Christie Pitts in 33 and armed with lead pipes, battled the Hitlerites. Taking leave of his body, we laid hands upon what remained of him, indivisible as ether, in the cab home, the animal scent of unwashed hair on our fingers. Okay. I don't know if I'm approaching the end of my time here. 10 minutes. I have 10 minutes, oh boy. Okay. Let's keep this going. No, I don't mean oi in the negative way. I mean it in the lesser known positive connotation of the word. I've had a lot of crappy garbage jobs in my life, and until now. Now I am well settled in life. But one of the jobs I had was I worked at a children's toy factory here in Montreal, and it was the most miserable job experience and environment of my life. And I was responsible at the time for client concerns, which would mean that parents would send me frantic emails asking if a certain toy was lead or gluten-free, and it was up to me to reassure them that their children would not die from licking alphabet cubes or what have you. So this email comes from that happy time. It's called Without Prejudice. Another day spent scanning emails from frantic parents. Subject line, this toy is defective. They attach photos of fluids they suspect are toxic, evidence I'm under orders to ignore. My first nail art salon weeps napalm. A cracked Etch-a-Sketch knockoff has been double-bagged and is on its way to our lab. Conspiracy theories about chemicals and developmental delays now hold water. The in-house lawyer has enjoined me to begin every standard answer with the shibboleth, without prejudice. The factory's front is blank concrete. I enter through a side door. At lunchtime, I find doll parts in the microwave, a measuring cup of fondued limbs, one hand gripping the glass lip, a head crying its features off to a soft, hairless apricot. The only employee without a car, I take the bus to the metro. The 115 makes a complete circuit of the park and its residents, makers of pharmaceuticals and industrial solvents. Men in cast-off ski jackets, stripped of tickets proving the wearer can afford conveyance up mountains, hasten from the factories to meet the bus, a sprawl of lunch boxes on their knees while I balance this season's purse. They call to each other in Spanish. Occasionally, one smiles at me. I bring out my paper. Endangered seals eating endangered salmon. The bus stops across the street from the station, a block from the crosswalk, a death trek in winter. I jaywalk along with the men across two lanes of rush hour traffic. Only I know it's not the cold that kills, but what a body must do to stay warm. This poem is about Passover and the practice at Passover of leaving out a glass of wine and a piece of matzah for Elijah the prophet to come and snack on. And every year my mother would leave out the glass of wine and the matzah, and then she would arrange for me not to be in the room, and she would also arrange for the sound of a door slamming. And then I would come back into the room and the wine would be gone and the matzah would be nibbled on, and she would tell me it was Elijah. And I guess I was a very gullible child because I believed her until I think my early 20s. I was telling friends of mine that, you know, every spring the ghost of a prophet who had been dead for thousands of years came to our house for a snack. So eventually my mother confessed that she was the one drinking the wine. And this is about that experience and other things. And it's called Inauguration. It has a little quote, I guess, to just explain what I just said, but I'll read it anyways. Elijah's role as precursor continues in Jewish tradition with the development of messianic expectations. At the Passover table, a place is set for Elijah in case he returns to inaugurate the messianic age. One. I didn't want you to live in a world without wonder, Mother said, by way of excuse. Every spring I'd asked, was it you? Then tell me the truth. Credit her, she was good, indignant even. Why is it so hard to believe? I had to leave home before she'd confess. Even the curtain blowing over the open window was her. Certainly the door slamming shut, the nibbled corner of the matzah she'd shown me before as she placed it on his plate, the wine in the silver-plated goblet from Montreal Judaica. Look at it, drained. What more did I need? Two. Faith, I asked. Herself, she gave. Three. After the last Seder, rinsing out tin foil for reuse, she spoke of her first date with Father, how just before curtain had leaned over a kiss, and plucked her gold-plated earrings off, Elijah seizing Jezebel's tribute to Baal. Four, her timing was as good as her word. Five, talk to her, says the nurse. She can still hear, I swear. Six, this can't be my life. I think I will read something a little lighter after that. It was heavier than I thought it would be. I guess this poem could be, it's called Roll Call, but it could be subtitled to All the Dirtbags I've Loved Before. It's, I forget the term for this. Maybe my former professor will know. When you write a poem, A, B, C, D, what is that called? And I should know that. You know, when you write a poem and each word starts with a letter of the alphabet, an alpha, it's escaping me as so many things are. No. Yes, thank you. So, this is what happens when 50 is like looming around the corner looking at you.
Do you have all 26 letters in English?
I believe I do, yeah. If I don't, I'm screwed, but I'm pretty sure I got them all in here. Okay, it's called Roll Call. A is for Adonis, who logged in as weekend daddy. B is for Bacchus, who swore he'd quit if we had a baby. C is for Cupid, who lived on a boat on blocks. D is for Daedalus, who picked my bike lock. E is for Ether, who was a Unitarian Rasta. F is for Faunus, who proposed to stay in Canada. G is for, and I'm going to mangle all these names. G is for Garyon, who said two words, join a gym. H is for Heracles, who knows this poem is about him. I is for Ixion, who used ashes for soap. J is for Jove, who used his webcam to grope. K is for Kronos, who gave Daedalus my pin. L is for Lycaon, who counseled taking it on the chin. M is for Momus, who liked to drunk dial. N is for Neptune, who swam off with Kyle. O is for Orestes, who blamed his dead mother. P is for Pan, who lived in her Chrysler. Q is for Quirinus, who asked why I just couldn't listen. R is for Remus, whose bro shanked him in prison. S is for Silenus, who couldn't do or teach. T is for Tantalus, who cruised girls out of reach. U is for Ulysses, who said, it doesn't count if it's head. V is for Vulcanus, who burned down my tool shed. W is for Walter, who said I couldn't go further. X is for Zuthus, who made an ass out of Walter. Y is for Yahweh, who couldn't pick up a phone. Z is for Zeus, who says, for our sakes, just die alone. I have no notion of time, and I apologize for that. I think I'll read this one now. Keeping in this mode of dating disasters, I guess I'll stay on that theme. This poem is called Wonder, and it contains a graphic description first stanza, so there you go. I tried to keep it clean as long as I could. Wonder, on offer at the public market near the Duomo, a dog mounts a woman from behind. On all fours, she appears as resigned as the Virgin on that fresco near my hotel. The illicit magazine costs 13 euros and comes shrink-wrapped in plastic. Or does this signor want a genuine Florentine leather vest? Postcard? Three sets of female buttocks caked in golden sand like milkless polenta above the tourist's taunt, wish you were here. This senora wants some other era of signs and wonders, not the bar at the Intercontinental in Old Montreal, where the specialty is absinthe minus the fairies. I've pledged to meet Jeff there tonight for half-price drinks during Cinq à Sept. Jeff got what he calls my details from a networking site I joined years ago. Just passing through for work, he pulled up my profile, thought he'd shoot me an email. See you at 5, I replied, sincerely. A link to Kama Sutra, the sensual arts, soon appeared in my inbox. Sorcery, no doubt. Then, from the American Board of Sexology, came a wondrous notice. Jeff thought you might like this. It's 11 at night in Florence. I'm drinking Chianti alone at the counter, watching two men debate in great depth the slicing of ham. With darting fingers, they demonstrate the requisite breadth, while Jeff awaits the redhead with the tattoo of a winged pig on her shoulder. On her rear, she's inked her mantra, wish you were here. This senora wants some other epoch, one with sighs and wonders, not a hard sell, some writing on my city's ramparts, faith in spells. And I think I will wrap. I keep looking at you like, am I done yet? Can I read one more and then I'll leave? This one is about Rosalind Franklin, the pioneering British scientist who discovered the DNA helix, but unfortunately did not receive credit for that discovery, so I'll read this one and then I shall leave. Rosalind Franklin in open-toe sandals. Her bare legs and open-toe platform pumps are what you notice last in the photograph of the young crystallographer at the conference. First, her hair, dark and loose, then her smile, the blouse open at the throat. Even in black and white, you can tell she's still tanned from hiking the Alps. She's on our right, about to open the door. The men on the left are next, in shadow, but then Rosalind's on the first step and in their light. 9 years before she dies, she's come to Lyon from Paris, where she works for fellow Jew Mehring at his convivial lab. A different photo shows her in checked shirtwaist, hair in a loose chignon, holding two Petri dishes full of the coffee they brewed in beakers. How could she not see the structure of DNA was a spiral staircase for inbred debutantes to descend? How could she not spot the base pairs reproducing without end, facing each other like inverted mirrors? Photograph 51, the first glimpse of DNA's helix. Rosalind took it with the same X-ray machine she had used in Paris. When she saw that X-ray of her ovarian tumor, it seemed benign in comparison. But for that day in the Lyonnais sun, England behind her, foot on the first rung. Thank you so much.